bottle up what's going down.
Hello, my name is Holly Hedgepeth, and I'm with the Cancer Services Program of Columbia and Greene County, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC ACRA.
Listen to music and voices. Listen to work and play. Listen to eat and drink. Listen to noise and fun. Listen to pink and blue. Listen to a heart rainbow. Listen to wizards and witches. Listen to jazz play. Listen to dogs and mice. Listen to Rome and Italy. Listen to Mars and Venus. Listen to the planet. Listen to teeth and trunks. Listen to Kaizen and Violet. Listen to Stars and Stripes. Listen to Texas. Listen to bells and waterfalls. Listen to churches and steeples. Dance and sing and listen and bells. Listen to making things, stripes and zigzags. Bike riding and zigzagging. No, listen to bike riding and curving. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio WGXC.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by the Olana Partnership, presenting Third Thursday, a day of tours and programs topped off by tunes with a view. Visitors can experience global sounds while taking in the views of the Hudson Valley. This month, featuring Mariachi Satali on Thursday, June 17th from 12 to 7 p.m. All are welcome. Details at olana.org/thirdthursdays.
You are listening to
Waveforms WGXC 90.7 FM Acre Catskill. And this is Radio for Open Ears. And my name is Mayuko. Bequency. This program is Bequency, like it says at the very beginning. Meet bird people in the Hudson Valley. Bequency invites the local community to be inspired by the joy, beauty, and wisdom bird enthusiasts find in the nature of our neighborhoods. Every episode features an interview with local bird people, plus a freeform mix of sounds made by birds and humans inspired by birds. And we started today's show with a song titled While the Birds Are Singing to Me by Brian G. Harlan and Joseph Belmont. And this was released in early this year, but obviously sounded pretty old. It was recorded in March of 1903, Edison Gold Molded Cylinder number 9583, it says here in the notes. And that's how we started today's show. And the guest, the local bird people that I interviewed for today's show, Kent, Connecticut. It's a little bit of maybe a stretch to say it's local, but I wanted to interview this topic of Purple Martins because this month, June 2025, Purple Martins, which is one of the largest species of swallows, appeared in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and that marked the first confirmed breeding record for the birds in the Berkshires in 130 years. This is part of a huge conservation success story of the collaborative efforts in Connecticut between the Marvelwood School, the Kent Land Trust, the Purple Martin Conservation Association, and the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. And these efforts have restored and expanded the Purple Martin breeding population in New England. And my today's guests, Laurie Doss and Ashley Wilkins, are two of the key individuals involved in this work. Laurie is the Science Department Chair at Marvelwood School and sits on the boards of directors for the Kent Land Trust and the Purple Martin Conservation Association. And Ashley is a Kent Land Trust intern, a former Marvelwood student, and now a University of Rhode Island sophomore studying animal science. They discuss the unique relationship between humans and purple martins, the bird's current conservation status, community partnerships, and the intergenerational commitment to martin conservation fostered by this work. They're going to also share ways we can help we can help purple martins, even in the Hudson Valley and surrounding areas, which is our neighborhood. So I hope you stay tuned and enjoy the interview. Thanks for tuning in. This is Bequency on WGXC. Thank you so much for taking time to do interview with me today. Could you briefly introduce yourselves?
I'm Laurie Doss. I'm chairperson of the science department at Marblewood School. I've been teaching here for 38 years. I'm also on the board of directors for the Kent Land Trust and the Purple Martin Conservation Association. And just a little side note, in 1984, I had the opportunity to work with Dr. Charles Brown, who's the world's foremost authority on cliff swallows and on swallows in general. And it was there that I was first introduced to purple martins, but not physically, just through reading the literature. I had never seen a purple martin until I was teaching at Marvelwood.
I'm Ashley Wilkins. I am a five-year Kent Land Trust intern. I was a student at Marvelwood in 2020 to 2024, and I am now a sophomore at the University of Rhode Island studying animal science and focusing in pre-vet.
This program is also geared towards birding beginners, so I would like you to describe what Purple Martin is in the first place?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Purple martins are members of the swallow family. They're actually the largest member. They're a neotropical species, which means that they come here to breed during the summer, and during their non-breeding season, they go all the way down to Brazil. There's sexual dimorphism, which means the male and the female look differently. The male is this sort of dark, navy blue, iridescent purplish color. It's more blue than purple overall. And then the female is a little drabber in color, not quite as colorful. They're birds that have a broad chest and a short little bill that have a little hook on them. And they're just beautiful birds. And it takes 2 years before the males get to their full color. So it helps us to distinguish the age of purple martins in the field because of the plumage color.
What would be the marking, would you, if you have, you know, when we see swallow-like things flying, some people say, let's say, when it's a forked tail, that would be barn swallow.
Correct.
If it looks like a cigarette with a wings flying, people often say about the swift.
Right.
Is there any easy way to tell from, even if you don't have a binocular or from far away, if there is?
Probably their size and their flight pattern. They don't tend to flap their wings a lot. They do a lot of gliding.
Okay.
Their tail, they have long wings, and their tail maybe has a slight notch in it, but not like the barn swallow at all, but short gliding flights, and then from afar, of course, their calls.
Okay,
their sounds.
So the sound, the length of the wings, flight pattern,
right, and the size comparison to the swallows most people know, which are the tree swallows and the barn swallows.
Right, right. Okay. So I was really fascinated reading about the unique relationship between this bird, purple martin, and humans, which has some of the articles shared from you. It says existed for hundreds or possibly even thousands of years. Could you tell us what it's about?
Sure. And first, I probably should say that purple martins are secondary cavity nesters. That means they nest in old abandoned woodpecker holes, in trees. They also will nest sometimes on cliffs or crevices on cliffs. But primarily thousands of years ago, the Native Americans, we believe, were drying gourds out in their gardens, in their villages, and purple martins started to nest in them. And then over time, people saw this and they started to erect their own renditions of purple martin housing when the early settlers came and they put them up. And this provided human-provided housing, coupled with the fact that they were losing habitat, they were losing nesting locations, and then competition with the English house sparrow and the European starling resulted in a complete tradition shift in nesting. So now the eastern subspecies of purple martins are entirely dependent on humans, and it all started with the, you know, indigenous groups 1,000 years ago.
That's pretty amazing. The cavity nesters, like kestrels losing housing, and so is purple martin. Is it related to trees cutting down?
Yes, with habitat loss. For example, first, a lot of people will not leave a dead tree or snag on their property. They'll cut it down. They're afraid it's going to come down.
Right.
And secondly, with habitat loss and development, they've lost these cavities. And then the few remaining cavities that exist, you've got fierce competition with the introduced species, the English house sparrow and the European starling.
Mm-hmm. Right, I see.
Out west, they'll still nest in natural cavities, the subspecies out there, and in the desert, but in the east, no.
I saw a picture in your material that they're nesting in the hole and cacti.
Yes, yes, the desert martin in the cacti. Yeah.
So they still get to live in natural habitat. Very interesting. Well, you already touched a little bit about the current conservation status of the purple martin, but could you tell us more about it?
Well, in Connecticut, when we first started this project around 2011 with the community partnership with the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, the bird was listed as a threatened species in the state of Connecticut. It is now listed as a species of special concern in Connecticut, primarily because of all the efforts to increase housing and to manage housing. But overall, if you're looking at purple martin populations, they have decreased by about 4.5 3 million in the last 50 years, and that's more people than Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So they're not a federally endangered species or anything of that nature, but because they're aerial insectivores and because they're so reliant on humans to provide nesting cavities, overall their population, you know, has declined.
There was a recent appearance of purple martin in Berkshire, and it's a big deal. Could you tell us why it's significant?
Yeah, I can, with what I know, I'll be happy to. I know that since 1895 in Berkshire County, there have not been any sort of confirmed nesting records. That was the last one. And there was a man named Jonathan Pierce who was out on a property near Lenox and discovered a few pairs of purple martins actually breeding in an old abandoned house. And that is significant because they haven't been there since 1895, which is, what, roughly 130 years?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're more common a little bit more along the coast of Massachusetts and in eastern Mass, but they're not common really in western Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I saw the map that there was lots of colonies along the shoreline, like mm-hmm. you just mentioned. Does that mean there are more people hosting colonies, or what's the reason?
Yeah, there probably have been a longer association with people hosting colonies. You know, what we've found is that Connecticut and Massachusetts have been sort of the last strongholds for purple martin populations in New England. The thing with Massachusetts, on the coast, there's always people that have lived there, but a lot of the houses inland have been abandoned. If you drive by the countryside, uh-huh. you know, the people don't have their farms anymore. You'll just see these old abandoned houses that have just been left there. And so the few breeding opportunities there are a few pairs of martins trying to still breed in these old houses.
Mm-hmm.
In Connecticut, in Massachusetts, according to the Breeding Bird Survey and the Purple Martin Conservation Association, the numbers are not increasing as much. They've sort of fallen flat in the state of Massachusetts, but in Connecticut, the trend is upward. So a lot of the work here we're doing in Connecticut to increase housing, I think, is spilling over into inland areas in Massachusetts, particularly the western side.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So really, it's because it's depending on people, where people don't live, they don't live either.
Or if they're not educated and they don't know how to care for purple martins, like, people may not know what this old house is for.
Right, right.
And the reason we know that there are birds that are sort of crossing the border there and going into Massachusetts is because we have a natal dispersal banding program.
Mm-hmm.
And they have reported some of the bands we've used at our colonies here in the northwest corner at that new site mm-hmm. near Lenox.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Laurie Doss and Ashley Wilkins in Kent, Connecticut, who are sharing stories about the positive impact of purple martin conservation efforts that have spilled over state lines and into our area. Thank you for listening. This is Bequency on WGXC 90.7 FM.
In the 2011 report written by Jeffrey Krukar,
yeah.
is how you
from the DEP, yeah.
DEP Wildlife Division. So this is an old report, I guess, 15 years ago. Many housing locations in Connecticut, including some adjacent to active colonies, are available, yet remain unoccupied. The reason for this lack of occupancy and use are not clear. The criteria these birds use for selecting nesting sites in Connecticut are not understood. This is 15 years ago. Have you found any reason why when martins don't nest?
I can't really comment on the state's study on what they found because I don't have all that data. I can just share with you our experience in the northwest corner.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a plethora of inland wetlands, so I think that helps because they eat dragonflies, damselflies, you know, various aerial insects, and I think these are like a a nursery for insects so that the purple martins can feed their young and feed themselves.
Right.
I also think they like the wide open swooping areas. And it tends to get a little chilly here inland, and what we've found that if they don't have the swooping areas and if the house doesn't get morning sun, it tends to be avoided. The two houses that were erected that did not get morning sun, they never were occupied. There have been some instances in the northwest corner where housing was too close to buildings or to garages or to barns, and just moving them out 100 feet increased the purple martin population at that site fivefold.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a variety of factors there. I think also management.
Also, I think housing types. There are a lot of old houses that we see that allow for invasive species. And they kick out the martins and like a lot of starlings, house sparrows. But gourds are definitely better, but we don't see that very often. A lot of metal houses and just the old houses are what are used, and those are easy for like wing entrapments and invasive species.
Mm-hmm. And I think historically they've used a lot of the round holes, which allowed both starlings and house sparrows to get in there very easily.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've adjusted the openings to sort of an oblong or rectangular hole opening, which excludes the starlings but can still allow the house sparrows. So I think newer housing, and I think we found that the gourds provide more insulation for the birds here than the metal houses do, particularly early in the season,
mm-hmm.
against the cold weather.
I guess all these things you mentioned, the design of the house or the environment, needs to be considered when, say, somebody wants to host
right.
a colony, and they can get help make that assessment, because obviously people are not capable of doing that themselves.
Yeah, and I think the best thing is, you know, it varies. We did a study for Texas Tech University where we were looking at temperature and humidity. Ashley was involved in that and trying to determine, does there need to be regional locations for housing types? You know, out in Texas and Oklahoma, they're having longer heat waves than we're having.
Hmm.
And so the jury's still out on that. But the best thing to do is to look around your area and see what type of housing purple martins are using and then try and duplicate that.
Mm-hmm.
We have found that they gravitate to the gourds quicker than they do some of the metal housing that's been placed up by others. And that is the best way to do that. And then in terms of individual people, I don't know if this is one of your questions, but I'll just say this here, so I think it sort of fits, is that individuals, they get older. I think the average age now for a purple martin host or ambassador is in their mid-60s.
Mm.
And so what happens when they get sick? What happens when physically they can no longer check the houses? There's difficulty recruiting the next generation, and that may be because there's not a lot of education about these birds in certain areas. And so in addition to encouraging individuals, we're also encouraging people to try and team up with local organizations, whether it be nature centers or land trusts, to erect housing, because that is a more sustainable model. If you have a land trust or a nature center, that's going to go on for a while.
Right.
They may lose a volunteer or a caretaker, but they can recruit a new person, or when they bring new interns in and train them. And so we're trying in each area to have more sustainability by encouraging various organizations to partner with the public.
Mm-hmm.
Or individual landowners, even if they have their land and conservation easements, so that it is a joint venture,
right.
and there's always a sustainable pool of people who are going to be able to care for the martins in the future.
Yeah, I was curious about that, because when I was reading the report, sometimes it was mentioned that colonies were abandoned,
mm-hmm.
and I wondered what could have been the reason. So people aging out and no longer taking care of it and all that. You know, I because I was wondering if it makes sense for, there are lots of private landowners in Hudson Valley who may be interested in doing stuff like this, but I guess it kind of has to be closer to already existing colonies.
Well, that's how we started, and we found, like, most will disperse within, like, 9 or so miles or so, but they'll go as far as 30-some miles, and I think the the site in the Berkshires is between like 30 and 33 miles. I'd have to check that.
Hmm.
So that is how why we were successful. We started with known colonies. We had a colony just down the road here from Marblewood School. That was where I first saw my first purple martin. We improved the house in there. And then they were nesting in broken lights up here, the street lights, and broken globes. And so we said, let's add a purple martin house here. And we took the old house from that side, added it here. And then we attracted martins just within a few weeks of setting that up. And then we improved the house in here. And so that is, I think, the best way is to reach out where there are known colonies of purple martins and look for suitable habitat and organizations. Maybe they could partner together and set up some housing.
I see. So if somebody in, say, Catskill wants to participate, it's not that distance is a problem. It's more about building the support team.
Yeah, support team. Well, the individuals can do it too. And but for us, our focus has been, because I had a bout of cancer a couple years ago, and when it's like all these purple martins in the northwest corner, what's going to happen to them? But fortunately, through Marblewood School's Avian Ambassador Community Service Program, and in working with Ashley and her brother over the summer and other students, they knew what to do. So when I was recovering from my chemotherapy, all I had to do was sit down and they occasionally asked me a question. But they were able to monitor, put up housing, you know, get the chicks, do nest changes. You want to add anything to that?
Banned birds
under my supervision. So if we hadn't had that to fall back on, what would have happened to these
Right. Yeah, that intergenerational relationship with the people working together was another thing that was really fascinating. And so I wanted to ask about the students participant in a little more detail.
And before we do that, I wanted to also say that this started out as a partnership originally between Kent Land Trust, Marblewood School, and the Purple Martin Conservation Association to try and restore inland populations here. And it's always been a partnership. And then we've added the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. We added that component as well. So our model has always been a community partnership. We've just emphasized training more people now in the event something happens. Okay.
So the students at Marblewood, we've helped to monitor and care for the birds. During the school year, we would take down, clean, and set up the gourds for the next summer of banding. When we had GPS tags on the birds, we would try and go out and we would take pictures to try and locate those birds to retrieve the GPS tag. And we've also given presentations, like during the winter when there was no martins around, so that we could educate like our local Audubon, like the Sharon Audubon, or just the local community martins to get people involved.
And I think another big thing is we received a grant from the Genium Foundation to increase housing at some of these sites, these community, you know, partnership sites like Audubon Sharon, to increase housing there. We received a grant to put housing up at the Housatonic Valley Regional High School, and that has been helpful. So these kids actually assemble the houses as well, dig the holes and put them up, because we know each individual organization doesn't have a plethora of resources to use to do this. So by having the students do this as part of their community service project throughout the year, and then some students who are local stay, it's made a big difference.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Laurie Doss and Ashley Wilkins in Kent, Connecticut, who are sharing stories about the positive impact of purple martin conservation efforts that's been spilled over state lines and into Hudson Valley. Thank you for listening. This is Big Wency on WGXC 90.7 FM.
What is the nest made of, by the way?
Well, inside the gourd, normally we'll start it off with putting in some like dry pine needles, but then the birds will bring in like sticks and leaves when they
grass, hay,
yeah,
things
like that. And once they start bringing in like green leaves, that's when we know that they're going to start laying eggs. We don't really know the purpose of the leaves yet, But
there's two theories. You know, some think it helps with parasites. Some think it helps with humidity. I would probably go with the humidity route because when you're incubating eggs, you have to keep the humidity a certain at a certain level to help with hatching. To go from there.
Yeah.
And what about the outer structure? That's people-made part.
That's just plastic. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it resembles the natural gourds. You know, there are many people who host purple martins who grow their own gourds, and then they will adapt them with tunnels and lids so they can check them. But these are just plastic gourds that sort of mimic the older gourds. And one of the problems with these older housings, older houses that have been abandoned that you see, is the compartments are too small. They're like 4 by 5 inches, and it's too small for like 4 to 5 chicks and the parents. So people who still insist upon the metal housing, they're being encouraged to, instead of having 12 cavity openings, to remodel the house so there's 6 cavity openings and to make the compartments bigger.
Mm-hmm. And somebody's manufacturing this, the plastic version of it?
Yes. Yeah, there's various organizations. Troyer is a big manufacturer of some. I know there's an excluder gourd. There's SNK. There's different companies that manufacture gourds. Some are better than others, but...
Okay. I also saw the photos of students banding, so they really get to have the first-hand experience of the bird.
Yeah. I actually, when I was, I think, just a freshman, I got to put my first band on a bird, which was super cool because I was really hoping I could. And now I get to put the color bands on, sometimes the USGS band, but it's just helpful to, because we get so many birds, it's just helpful to like move the line along to have.
So it's that busy when
it's that busy. And so actually the bird that was located with the yellowish gold metal band, which is an alphanumeric band, and it had the blue plastic band on it, they were able to get a number off the color band, and Ashley helped band that 2 years ago. I put on the USGS band and she put on the color band. And is it rewarding to...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Very cool.
I was thinking it was almost like sending your kid off to college. It's not that sad, but it's kind of what it feels like, because then you get to see them like kind of grow up in a sense and thrive and like break records of breeding. It's just very fulfilling.
Right.
Yeah, because only about 25% of the nestlings actually will even survive their first year. Because there's so many perils on the migratory journey. Do the parents abandon them early if they've nested late? Predators, whatever it may be. So that is one reason why we've tried to have colonies that are sort of medium size and have several smaller colonies sort of dabbled around the northwest corner. Because the more young we can get to survive, the better off it's going to be for the population.
Can't quite picture. Seeing lots of students in the picture, it's like, what are they? Are they going to just stand around? But they have a lot of things to do at the site.
Yeah, we have like a lot of them. They will age the birds and take data while we ban them.
I see.
And they can also, if we have groups of people, they'll take the birds and show them how to age. So then we can also get other people involved in that.
And then they shuttle the birds back and forth. They put them, you know, we number the bucket with the gourd number and the gourd rack, and we band the birds, and then we have people who shuttle them and put them back and bring us new birds.
Right, so that's
trying to make it as efficient as possible.
That's quite a big operation.
Yeah.
So when you say age the bird, you mean like checking the feathers and all that?
Yeah, so like we see how much like the feather shafts have come out of the bird. We check the coloration of the bird too, the size of the bird. We have like a chart that we'll look
at. For nestlings.
Yeah, for
nestlings. Yeah.
Adults are different, but for nestlings, that's what we do.
And so students have like, do you get like first lecture in the classroom and then hit the field, or how does that work? They get trained, right?
Right, they do get
because
trained.
You need to know how to do this.
They get trained because when we're managing the colonies and doing nest checks, we have, when the young first hatch, we have to age the bird too. And so we do this in small steps throughout. And Ashley is probably the only student I've, you know, in terms of putting the metal color bands on, that I really allow to do that. The plastic bands are a little easier to put on. You just slide them on with this spatula, this little metal spatula, and you just snap them shut. Mm-hmm. But the metal banding or the USGS banding requires a few more skills,
right,
to make sure you don't injure the bird. So we don't let many students do that part of it.
Yeah, that handy skill is separate from your love for birds.
Oh, yeah.
You either can't
do it
or
you can't. And the other thing, it's not just marvelous. It's a lot of times it's marvelous students who become interns for the Kent Land Trust who are then training interns from Audubon Sharon, interns from other land trusts in the area with their internship program. We've been at Bend of the River, Audubon, with they have something called the Junior Forest Technicians, and they've been coming out now, I think this is the fifth or sixth year. They have a crew of about 12 that will come and help us at Marvelwood to band. And they're designed to expose kids mm-hmm. to different career options and work that goes in to conserve a species.
Mm-hmm. I'm really grateful for any of these youth programs because the impact that it would have on people's lives, you know, as they become an adult, having this firsthand, really close experience with the birds. This is something I thought about the Ben Nicholas Kestrel mm-hmm. Nest Box project too, that each collaborator of his project, they get to have an event and kids come and they get to see the chicks. And that's like really big impact. And, you know, just seeing young people so interested and focused about wildlife or any of their interests. I just had a walk. I'm a member of Allen DeVoe Bird Club, and the club had a walk with a New York State Young Birders Club, mm-hmm. and they came with a big camera and everything, and they're really engaged, like so interested, and like, who says these kids these days don't have long attention span? These kids can focus 3 hours. Yeah. And that's like, that really gives me a hope about future.
It sure does, and I think the more you can expose them and give them hands-on experience,
mm-hmm.
the more you're going to reel them in.
Yeah.
And it's not just kids. When we've done programs for adults, they've now wanted to become volunteers. And we have one member of the Kent community who is now monitoring one of her colonies on her own, just mild input from us, so it frees us up to do other things.
Mm.
And the way I try and let schools and conservation organizations and land trusts know is that purple martins are an easy species to study. They're an easy species to monitor if you've got all the right setup. But they're almost like a gateway species into conservation, because people who can work with purple martins and work to maintain their populations in the state or increase them, they're going to be more likely to engage in other conservation projects.
Mm.
Or they're going to be more likely to contribute to, let's say, funding to help various organizations or to do the conservation work or to fund internships.
I think that's a good place to ask about the community support, since we touched on that topic a little bit. So what can people do? How can the community support the work you do and the conservation of purple martin?
Do you want to handle that, Ashley?
Sure. So the smallest thing is donations. That would be like the smallest thing. Education, so like giving presentations, and if we give a presentation to someone, they can go out and educate like the next group of people. So it's just like a little line of people there.
And if I could interject there, we also have some stock presentations that are prepared that will be able to be accessed later this year from the Kent Land Trust website. So if people want to take our presentation and adapt it to their area, they can do that, because that's been a big barrier in the past, is conveying the right information
mm-hmm.
and having ready-made presentations to help go into local schools. So people who are retired, you know, they could even go into local schools and give these presentations
wow.
to educate the community.
Can they ask you to, like, let's say if I want to do it, I'm afraid to do
yeah.
it, but if somebody wants to do it,
yes.
like, can I practice, and like you give a feedback and all that? You
get
a little bit of training.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's
yeah.
great. Yeah.
Another way you can become a member of the Purple Martin Conservation Association, just to learn a little more about the research and just be able to support them. You can host your own colony,
mm-hmm.
Like we talked about before. You can volunteer, like we have that new volunteer in Kent. We could always use more. Oh, protecting inland wetlands and plant native species.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of invasive species that we need to help get rid of, but planting native species is a good way to protect them.
Because it provides food sources, mm-hmm. and protecting inland wetlands provides food sources for martins and other birds as well.
Yeah, yeah, there's many ways to help these martins.
And then another way would be, even if you're into photography and you're going out and looking at different colonies, it's been really helpful to get pictures from the community, either on eBird or, you know, finding out directly, you know, who bands in the state, and sending us photos of color-banded birds. It helps us to understand where they're dispersing to, how far they're dispersing to, and where new areas to target. Like, you know, the Berkshires now near Lenox, you know, if you find suitable habitat, putting up new housing might start to attract even more purple martins to the area. And I know we gave Ben and his crew our old Texas Tech setup with some gourds so that the martins that are breeding in this new area in Lenox now, when the young fledge, or even the adults, they can check out this gourd rack, become familiar with it, and they're more likely to come back to the area to breed the following year or go to an area near that, the young. They'll return to their natal colony, but they usually get pushed out. Only about 10% of the young birds will be able to breed at the natal colony. They usually get pushed out and dispersed, and they're looking for housing in other areas. And once the young fledge from the nest, they're like, are there any potential martin hotels in the area where I could come back next year? But if a bird has been successful breeding, then the adults will come back to the same area to breed, and you can even introduce improved housing, which is what we did over time, to enhance their success.
Mm. Right, because when you see a photograph, you can tell where they come from, from the color
band
of the band.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
And if you get the number, we can tell you the exact year that they were banded.
Oh, yeah. That'll be exciting, yeah. Well, so how can people, you said the volunteer and all that, how can people get in touch with you? What's the best way to?
The best way would be through my email address.
Okay.
And I can, would you like me
that's
to give
okay
that to you
to
now?
Share.
Yeah, that's fine. It's Lori, Laurie, dot Doss, Doss, at Marvelwood, Mar, V as in Victor, Elwood, .org.
Mm-hmm. I will also have this information in the show notes so people can copy and paste. So if they want to join as a volunteer, a host of the colony, they can just email you and find out more information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Purple Martin.
There's a sunset brimming over the sky, and there's a swallow teaching its young how to fly. The moon cries, see how fast the summer passes by. There's an oak leaf turning green into brown, and there's a pine so proud of her evergreen gown, looking down, see how fast the winter
when it swallows. Come back to Capistrano. That's the time. I hope that you come back to me when you whisper farewell in Capistrano. That's the time the swallows flew out to the sea. All the mission bells would ring, the chapel choir would sing, the happiness you bring when we go hand in hand. When the swallows come back to Capistrano, that's the time. I hope that you come back to me when you whisper farewell in Capistrano. That's the time the swallows flew out to the sea. That's a Gene Autry song.
When the Swallows Come Back to Capistrano by Michael Hurley from his 1971 album Armchair Boogie. Ahead of that was English singer-songwriter Vashti Bunyan, and she gave a swallow song from her 1970 album, Just Another Diamond Day. And then ahead of that, we heard Papa Martin field recordings from the Stokes Field Guide to Bird Songs. Huge thanks to Laurie and Ashley for the wonderful interview. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And thanks also to Ben Nickley of Berkshire Bird Observatory for making this really special connections and intro for me. And also the alert for the Purple Martin appearance, the first breeding, confirmed breeding in Berkshire, like they mentioned in the interview, the first one in 130 years. So I think that is a kind of a big deal. And I had never seen Purple Martin until this visit myself. So this was what they call lifer for me. So in many ways, this was truly an exciting experience for me to visit the colony and talk to them and see the chicks, bunch of chicks and eggs, and the also beautiful adult birds of Purple Martin. And I'll be posting all that photos and videos that I took. I shot really a bunch of them. So I'll be posting those visual materials along with a transcript of this interview that also includes all the relevant links and the email address that Laura mentioned, that you, if you want to contact her, you can copy and paste from there. These are all going to be posted on Bequency website, which is at bequency.substack.com. The show notes on this WGXC Bequency website will also include all the contact information and some photos and everything. But there's some tons of videos that I wanted to, you know, show that really needs a lot of online space. One of the videos include the one of them, Lori demonstrates how people use a kind of a chart that has photos of chicks of different ages, like two days old, 3 days old, and then like up to 12 days old, 13 days old. They all look very different. And so they use that kind of chart to age the chicks, as they were saying also in the interview. And she demonstrates with an actual chicks right next to this chart, and that's just so very cute. And so I hope you will check it out also, you know, just to bring a little bit of happiness into your life. Again, these will be posted on bequency.substack.com. And Thanks to everybody who supported WGXC's fundraiser, Ripples Make Waves Pledge Drive, which ended yesterday, but there's another fundraiser event tomorrow, Sunday, June 29th. This is organized by Justin Calder for his Sunday Night Swim series. You know, that's been running at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill. And there will be two great ambient sets, Grains of Euphoria and Music for Furniture. The doors open at 7:30 p.m. And so it's not a last chance. You can always support if you want WGXC Waveform and WGXC. But today is a great opportunity to do so while having a great time listening to beautiful music. So check it out. And I would like to play this brand new release. It's not even come out yet. It's going to be released on July 25th this year. A bird-related tune by a Japanese artist, Yoichi Kamimura. And he's releasing an album titled Ryuhyo. And in the release note, it says, recorded over 4 years, the album shares the intricate soundscape birthed by Ryuhyo, Japan's drifting sea ice in the Sea of Ohotsuku. I'm pronouncing it in the Japanese, how Japanese people call that ocean. I guess it's a Russian name, but I don't know how Russians pronounce it. But anyhow, in the Sea of Ohotsuku by the coast of Hokkaido, that's in the northern part of Japan. And this album includes some really mysterious recording of Shimafukuro. And Shimafukuro, I had to look up, but I think in English-speaking countries, it's called Black Kistan's Fish Owl. It's one of the world's largest fish owls. And so I want to play that for you before I go. So stay tuned. You're listening to Waveforms, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Radio for Open Ears. And this is Frequency. Thanks for listening. So that was the Shimafukuro's field recordings, along with Sea Ice in Hokkaido, in northern Japan. Shimafukuro, Blackistan's Fish Owl, recorded by Yoichi Kamimura, and it was from his upcoming release, Ryuhyo, and this will come out in July 25th, 2025. You've been listening to Waveforms, WGXC Acra 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. Coming up next is WGXC Music Committee Picks. Tune in for a selection of local music and new releases from the WGXC Music Committee. So stay tuned. This program has been Bequency, Meet Bird People in Hudson Valley. And I've been Mayuko. I'm here every fourth Saturday of the month at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. So I'll be back on July 26th. I hope you'll come back and join me again. Thanks for listening and have great birding.